So all this month, settling into this new space, being at a yoga studio, quote unquote, or a new yoga studio anyway, I've wanted to talk for a while in some more detail about the crossover or places where the Buddhist and Hindu yoga traditions intersect or don't, and some of the relationship between the Buddhist practice that I primarily offer from and what we think of as, quote, yoga, unquote, practice, which mostly in terms of studio practice means a practice of holding or moving through physical postures in lineages that come from both northern and southern Indian Hindu traditions, both Shaiva and Vaishnava are Shiva-oriented and Vishnu-oriented traditions, but primarily Hindu-oriented traditions. And the roots of both of these lineages, the modern Buddhist tradition, has come to the West through many different pathways, through Southeast Asian lineages, sometimes called Theravada or Vipassana or insight meditation, through Himalayan lineages, from Tibet, Bhutan, Nepal, through East Asian lineages, from China, Korea, and Japan, and Vietnam, which is a hybrid tradition. And all of these different forms having evolved from the same roots, that in the 4th or 5th century BCE, there was a social movement in India where seekers were leaving the cities and setting out into the wilderness to seek for an individual liberation, a liberation that was not tied into the Brahmin-centered ritual of fire sacrifice and communal kind of ecosystem maintenance, a ritual sacrifice to elemental gods. And as part of this social movement of seekers going into the wilderness to find liberation, a whole body of new disciplines arose. Some of them were the ascetic practices that are probably the most ancient roots of physical yoga, the practices of putting the body into intense positions or situations, like immersing the body in icy water in the winter, baking the body under the hot sun in the summertime, surrounded by fires, hanging upside down for long periods of time, staring at the sun until the eyes dissolve into darkness, holding a limb in the air, or standing without sitting down for years at a time. These are some of the earliest practices that were said to, or thought to, or felt to burn up, in a way, the momentum of suffering that played out, called karma. That through our actions and the conditions that give rise to our experience, we were disoriented, in a way, in relation to reality. And we have such bad habits, habits of grasping, habits of fearing, habits of hatred and confusion, that we needed to cut through these in some way. And some of the earliest insights into how to cut through these were the insights into the relationship of individuals to particularly experiences that we could call pleasant and unpleasant. So, you know, one simple formulation that started to arise at this time was the idea that if our suffering is based on a kind of instinctive response to experience where we dislike pain and we really like pleasure, and therefore we resist aspects of reality that are painful, even if they're inevitable, and we grasp at and cling to aspects of reality that are pleasurable, even though they can't really be preserved or held onto, they're impermanent, that those reactivities, hating the painful and grasping the pleasurable, those are the source of our distress. That is why we're unhappy. And they were like, oh, you know, because we can't stop the natural cycle from unfolding. You can't stop. Once you have a body, it's going to die. You know, once you love something, you will eventually lose it. They focused on this, like, it was a very sort of cool analysis of things. And they're like, yep, you know, love means eventual loss. Embodiment means eventual sickness and death. And this was all embedded in this a new idea, which was the idea that souls or beings or individuals or impersonal energetic forces take birth in a sequence of bodies that would be taken on and then discarded like outfits of clothing. And this runs through much of yogic history, is like dealing in some way with our presence in eternity, where eternity really meant like you've worn innumerable bodies and you will wear innumerable more bodies. And the text literally says, just as when you wear out an article of clothing, you throw it aside and put on a new one, so too, when this body is worn out, does the soul throw it aside and take on a new one. And the sages who went out into the forest, they were like, okay, that means that as long as I'm doing this suffering thing, hating the unpleasant and grasping onto the pleasant, I just keep running through bodies doing that same thing over and over and over. And their conclusion was, this is intolerable. This is a terrible state of affairs, right? They weren't like, okay, well, there's so much beauty in life, let's just keep doing that. Mm-hmm. That's often a conclusion, I think, of privileged Westerners who haven't experienced much pain. When I teach on reincarnation, sometimes people are like, well, what if you just appreciate life and it's okay that you just keep coming back? And I'm like, what? How amazing it is that you must have so much pleasure in your life that you would think that about life. But look around the world, right? Not everyone has the luxury of thinking that. Oh, life is so awesome, let's do it again and 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 again for fucking ever, right? Most of the religions in the world, or many anyway, not actually a majority, but like, all of the Western religions, they say, life is really hard. Do it right, and you'll land in pleasure forever, or you land in ease or security forever, called heaven. And that's a beautiful vision because it recognizes that something goes on past the body. And none of the major religions are nihilistic. None of the major religions, except Western scientific materialism, which I will call a religion now, proposes that when the body dies, it's just over and there's blackness forever, like darkness, done, nothing goes on, right? There's no consciousness, there's no soul, nothing, none of that can be pointed to. The body is a material thing and consciousness is an artifact of materiality, and so when you die, you're done, right? That's a philosophical view that the early yogic systems called nihilism. Because if you believe that, at the end of the body there's nothing, why would you have any reason to act ethically, right? There would be no real result of your actions. Maybe there's a small-scale result, like if I'm mean to somebody, they have a hard time, and then I don't feel very good. But, you know, in the course of the whole thing, it doesn't matter much. Why would I not then just be a kind of unethical hedonist, just pursue pleasures as much as I can in this life, and when I die, it's over. And if we look around our culture, we will see a lot of people acting, I think, as if that is, in fact, what they believe. Nothing means anything, therefore, get as much good stuff as you can, and it's over. I don't know about you when you hear it, and I'm painting it a little bit dark, but I think, perhaps appropriately, for me, this feels like a very bitter worldview. I can't prove that something happens after we die. And all the traditions, they try, right? The Buddhist and yogic traditions have an amazing body of doctrine around like what happens after we die and how the reincarnation process happens. And it's complex because the Buddhists will also say that there's no particular individual thing that gets reincarnated. Like there's no soul in Buddhism to get reincarnated, and yet you have taken body after body after body after body. What does that mean? That's very mysterious, right? You have to ask, like, well, what is it that's been taking all these bodies if there's not a thing? And the Buddha would kind of go like, the question you should be asking is not that. The question you should be asking is, I'm still unhappy. How can I fix that? Right? The Buddha was a pragmatic teacher. And he said, like, don't worry about that part. That will make itself clear once you are awakened. You'll understand how you can simultaneously not have a self and have been reincarnated a gazillion times. He said, the question you should ask is, it's clear that I'm still suffering. What can I do in relation to that? And so this was the question of all of these seekers. How do I deal with pleasure and pain, essentially? Which really means, how do I deal with pain? Because we don't really worry about how to deal with pleasure. Mostly it's like, more please. The only problem with pleasure is that it's fleeting, and so that which is painful. So then again, the problem is pain, not pleasure. The problem is, when I get what I want, I notice that it's already slipping out of my fingers. Right? I found my beloved, and I married her. But already, by the time we got married, it was clear that it wasn't actually the thing that I, you know, might have romantically hoped, which is to say it wasn't perfect, right? And that happens with everything. So, at the heart of both the Buddhist and yogic traditions is the wrestling with the problem of dissatisfaction or pain. The word is dukkha. I like dissatisfaction as a translation for it. Suffering is the standard translation. So then there were all of these possible solutions. One was torment the body. The word is tapas, which means heat. Basically, you know, bake the body as if bad karma was a kind of moisture that could be dried up. And this is a metaphor that gets used in the later Hatha Yoga tradition, to dry up the body, to bake it like a pot in the kiln so that it gets hard and strong. You might not like that metaphor. Like, we like our bodies juicy and soft. But that wasn't the Hatha Yoga metaphor at different points. Tapas means heat. So do painful things, the ascetic tradition would say. And what happens if you do a whole bunch of painful things? First of all, you get used to it. And it a little bit makes sense to me. Like, shift your relationship to pain by having a lot of pain, intentionally, and kind of just like face it off, right? I don't recommend this to anyone nowadays. And the Buddha didn't recommend it. The Buddha tried it, and he said that of the painful things that people could do pursuing liberation, I have gone further than anyone. He nearly died. He basically starved himself. He said, you know, he wore uncomfortable clothes. He went naked in the summer and winter. He slept on a bed of thorns. He didn't eat anything. He held his breath until his head was splitting open. There's this long list of practices, and it's actually one of the best lists of ascetic practices we have from that period. It actually tells us about what people were doing. And he says, I tried all of that, and it didn't work. And so when he realizes that it didn't work, he realizes a couple things. And one is that he has to nourish the body. That part of ascetic practice had been fasting nearly to death. He says, I was so thin that when you touched my belly, you touched my backbone. And when you touched my backbone, you touched my belly. And my ribs were hanging out like the jaunty rafters of an old barn. And if I rubbed my body trying to bring some life back into them, the hair fell out at the roots. Right? It's this portrait of a man seeking liberation destroying his body to try to find it. And he almost dies. And he basically says, if I go further with this, I'll be dead. And that's not the solution. So what else is there? And he has this insight that he had a moment as a child when his father was doing a plowing festival. His father was like a, you know, the head of an area. He was wealthy landowner. So his father was kind of leading a plowing festival, and the kid was just hanging out in the woods. And he says, I was just sitting there. It's a plowing festival, so it's a spring day, so it's gorgeous out. And he said, I was sitting under a rose apple tree. And sitting there, comfortable, at ease, my mind naturally settled into a state of composed focus, a composed, effortless focus, called the first jhana or dhyana. So a very gathered meditative state that has as its core characteristics focus and pleasure. And the state is characterized actually by an experience called piti, which means like rapture or blissful pleasure in the body. It's an embodied pleasurable state. And the Buddha thinks in his nearly dead state, he thinks, oh, that day when I was a kid and it was so nice and I just sat and my mind got quiet in a way where the body was happy. He says to himself, maybe this is the way, not what I've been doing. And he gets this intuitive hit that, yes, this is indeed the way. In order to do this practice, he knows he needs nourishment. And because it's a myth, magically, just at that moment, there appears a wealthy woman from the town. Her name was Sujata. And she was bringing an offering of highly purified milk rice to offer to a tree spirit where the Buddha had been practicing, because months before she had prayed to that tree spirit for a son, had gotten a son. The son was now born and healthy, and she was coming back to give a gratitude offering to this forest spirit. And she came and she saw this kind of ghostly man sitting underneath a huge tree. She thought it might be the spirit and offered the rice to him. And it turned out to be our hero, Gotama, who was recovering from the most painful part of his quest. And in one of the commentaries, it says that she realizes that he's an ascetic seeking freedom and not the tree spirit. She decides it's auspicious to give the rice. He looks like he really needs it, I think, to give the offering to him. And then she says, knowing that he is seeking freedom and clearly hasn't found it yet, she says, as I achieved my aim, so may you. And I love very much, this is commentarial, it's not in the suttas itself, but I love very much that there's this tradition that proposes that at this moment, kind of the hinge of Gotama's practice from unwholesome or harmful practice that also isn't going to lead to the goal he seeks, toward practice that will be wholesome and will lead to the goal, that he remembers childhood, he remembers pleasure, and that a woman shows up with nourishment and gives him a blessing that's interwoven with her own seeking for the blessing of having a child. So all of this is a beautiful moment in his story. So he nourishes the body, and then he sits down to practice, and he enters these states that are embodied, blissful, and profoundly focused. And he unfolds toward liberation, in which the process of becoming liberated is to use the highly focused mind. The first thing he looks at is his past births. So that is the substance of his realization also. The first insight is, I saw into my past births, 1, 5, 10, 100, 1,000, 1,000,000 past births, where I was born, what I did, what I ate, somehow that's in the list, how I passed away, and where I was reborn next. And he sees this long sequence of essentially how we move through different states according to our actions and the conditions around us. And this is part of him seeing, like, oh, this is how it works, right? Because of craving and fear, I make different choices, and those choices guide what happens next for me. And we can see that this is true in our own lives, even if you don't go past life, right? I can be like, you know, I was craving recognition and sensual pleasures, so I became a musician. But then that didn't really work out for me. I was unhappy. I was craving more peace of mind and a more embodied life and more sensual pleasures, so I became a dancer. And then, and it just went on like that, right? I had a whole life as a musician, and then I died as a musician, and I was reborn as a dancer. And my whole life as a dancer, and then I died as a dancer, and I was reborn as an experimental performance artist. And then I died as a performance artist, and I was reborn as a monk. And then I died as a monk, and I was reborn as a confused ex-monk, etc. Right? Whatever your sequence is, that was part of mine. And then I died as a person who almost became a monk, and I was reborn as a person in a relationship. Right? And then I died as a single person and became a married person. And then I died and became a father, etc. And in all of these, I can feel how my choices based on wanting ease and being afraid of pain guided my choices, right? And it's not wrong that I do so. That's what we do. But the awakening instructions, they tell me to look at those choices, even the good ones, right? It was beautiful to have a child, and my boy is like a source of incredible joy. And to really still look at that and be like, I did that because I wanted something. And because I wanted something, I am in this state now, and this state has aspects of suffering to it, right? It's hard raising a child. I just got one of my first full nights of sleep in almost 2 years last night. Praise to the gods. My child decided to skip his normative 4:30 a.m. nursing that we all wake up for and just sleep straight through till dawn and a little bit beyond. To the point that when I woke up, I was kind of confused. And I was like, I feel so alert. And I don't have that weird, uncomfortable buzzing in my body that is the marker of being underslept. Amazing. So that, you know, there is suffering, right? And we suffer because we take birth in a new form. So the Buddha sees all of his births, etc. That goes on. He gets fully awakened. Jai Buddha. But what I want to talk about for the rest of our time is this new quality that he comes upon that becomes the central tool in both the Hindu and Buddhist yogas for 1,000 years or more, until the tantric period when other things start to get invented, like magic spells and whatnot. But the early tool that remains central for the whole history of yoga is this tool of focused attention that is embodied and pleasurable, but extremely stilled, extremely still. And we call it samadhi. Sama means to bring together, but also to balance. And dhi is related to the root for like the mind or the faculties or the energetic kind of being. I like the translation unification of mind for samadhi, where we have to recognize that mind here doesn't mean just the thinking organ, and I point to my head, that's our standard, but it really means unification of the whole internal system. So thoughts and feelings and sensations and the consciousness of all those things and perception is all gathered together in a focused stream. And it's a little bit like, the feeling for me is a little bit like focusing a camera lens. That when my lens is unfocused, it has a kind of wide aperture, but nothing is quite clear. The mind sort of jumps from thing to thing. I get little flickers of things. But when I focus, not only does the image become quite clear and sharp, but it narrows in a certain way. I can see certain things and not other things, right? If I focus, let's say I focused on a spot on the wood floor with my camera, for most lenses anyway, if I focused on that spot, the things that were in the background of the image, like you people over there, would be blurry, right? Like you can focus on one thing and not everything. So it's the same in the mind. If we take on like the breath concentration, I focus on the rising and falling of breath, one of the things that happens is my mind selectively chooses that thing and ignores everything else. This is what we do in meditation all the time, right? I ignore the sounds of traffic. I even kind of ignore the cool breeze. For me, the traffic is slightly unpleasant, the breeze is slightly pleasant. But if I'm practicing samadhi or focus, I let those various sensations, whether pleasant or unpleasant, just happen without pulling my attention. If my focus is not strong, if I have a disposition toward distraction, which I do, which many of us do, maybe most, maybe I focus on the breath, but then the wind comes in and I'm like, oh, cool breeze, that's so nice, it was such a hot day. Wow, we're having such a heat wave, right? And I could go on in that way. And what has happened is that my focus was not stable. I landed with the breath, but then some sensory input came in that triggered a chain of thoughts. And even though my awareness of the breeze was pleasant, and even though that was in a certain way in the present moment, like it's happening now, the fact that I don't notice it clearly and stay with my object, or notice it clearly but not get distracted, means that my mind may have the tendency to leap off into thinking about that thing. Right? I'm focused on the breath, I hear the traffic, and my mind goes, geez, like 25 years meditating in the city, I'm always listening to the sounds of traffic. Maybe one day I'll be able to live in the wilderness, in a quiet little house, in a meadow with some trees, and all I would hear is the trickle of a little brook. Wouldn't that be nice? I hear there's land up by Ukiah. You know, and again, the mind goes. And this happens so often. The seed of distraction is a sensation, very often. It's either a flicker of a memory, but it's often caused by or initiated by a physical sensation. You smell something, and suddenly it's like, oh, you know, the bagels from Moishe's shop on 51st Street. It's like, and then you go, and I'm in New York for 5 minutes. Mm-hmm. And I come back, like, oh, wait, what was I doing? Breath, 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 you know. Mm-hmm. Even the object itself can trigger thought, right? I'm like, okay, breath focus, breathing in, breathing out. But then I start to think like, maybe I should breathe a little deeper. Oh, but there's kind of a little tension in the top of my ribs. Well, maybe if I sort of relax my sacrum down and back and okay, what if I just imagine my breathing in light? That'll do it. Okay, breathing in light, breathing in light. I don't know, that's not really working. So this is a tendency of the mind, right? The early Buddhist word is papancha, which means proliferation. Samadhi is the absence of proliferation, or in Patanjali's language, it's the absence of the continual unfolding of the mind or heart material, the citta vrittis, in their habitual patterns. Patterns like complaining or overanalyzing or wanting or fantasizing or judging or self-hatred. These are all what are called vritti patterns or spinning, but they're structural, right? This is how we know who we are. I'm like, oh yeah, well, I'm someone who you know, is a little bit mean to myself, but, you know, for a good cause, right? That's my personality, so I think. That's a citta vritti. So every time my mind goes, okay, baby, you're not really doing this very well, try to focus again, okay? You can do this. That might be encouraging, but it's also a pattern, and it's my personality pattern. And so every time that happens, I'm reinforcing this thing that is actually not focus. So all of this is to say, this is the system that arose in the earliest kind of 1,000 years of yoga. So the Buddha, Patanjali, the Sankhya system, Vedanta, early Vedanta, Jainism, all used this orientation toward experience as the primary thing, and this focus as the primary practice. I'm going to talk a little more about the body and pleasure piece, because this is important. In all of the early systems, both Buddhist and, when I say yoga, right now I'm saying capital Y yoga, meaning classical yoga of Patanjali, which turned into Hindu yoga. It wasn't Hindu yet, but it was adopted by the Hindus, sort of. Yoga in all of these early systems is recognizes something that's amazing about our bodies and minds, body, minds, one thing now. And this is mysterious. And for me, this is a little bit like, why does this happen? I'm not sure. But when the mind is focused, when there's not a lot of extraneous thought, when I'm not pulled into the stories of strong emotions, but the energies of my body, mind are just present, unfolding, and I'm gathered. It's not only focused, but a mysterious thing starts to happen when that focus becomes strong, which is that the experience of the physical body changes, and it changes in the direction of bliss and pleasure. And this is, I don't actually have a good, like, modern biomechanical physical reason why this should be the case. But it's the case, and it shows up in all of the traditions. When the mind gets gathered, even a little bit, it starts to feel good. I think partly because distraction is jangly, and steadiness is just pleasurable for in the nervous system. And this is in parentheses back to the trauma conversation we had last month or the month before last. Calm in the nervous system is an indication that I'm safe, right? I'm not vigilant for threat, and the feeling of safety is also pleasurable. So there's a correlation between calm and pleasure and safety, and all three of those are kind of woven together. So as the mind focuses and feels safe, one of the first experiences to arise is the bodily experience of pleasure. And it takes a bunch of forms. It can be calm, sweet, smooth pleasure. It can be strong, jangly pleasure. It can be kind of bursting, orgasmic pleasure. It can be like still water runs deep kind of pleasure. But in all of the cases, it's physical. And the metaphors or the similes that in the Buddhist texts used to describe this are all physical similes. The first of them, there's a string of them, they're beautiful. The first of these images is an image of how to deepen in meditation, basically. And it says, as the mind concentrates and the thoughts are gathered in a single stream, the meditator kneads and massages the sensations of pleasure into the whole body in the way that a bathman or a bathman's apprentice kneads and massages water into a pile of bath powder until it becomes a ball of bath powder that that is completely saturated with water but doesn't drip. It's a very precise simile, right? The Buddha is a wealthy person. He had servants or slaves to make his bath for him. And apparently what you did was you scooped up some bath powder, which was dry. You added water, you sprinkled water on it, and you massaged it together like you would dough, essentially, until it is saturated but doesn't overflow. That's the image. So think about meditation and think about the act of concentrating. You gather your attention, you settle in, and you orient toward the whole body in the posture, and you feel the breath or your whatever your object is in the whole posture, and it starts to feel good. And the instruction is, take that feeling of pleasure and work it through your entire being so that no part of your body doesn't feel it. Right? What an interesting metaphor or simile to be an opposite to the ancient model of tapas heating the body and drying it out. This is the opposite. You moisten the body with pleasure until the whole body feels that pleasure and it doesn't leak out. As these similes go on, they get more and more effortless and more cooled out. So a couple steps down the way, the simile is just as though some lotuses grow, blossom underwater, so that the entire flower is open under the surface of the water, so that the entire lotus flower is permeated and saturated with the cool, still water, so too you should make your whole body. And again, the sense is like, oh, the whole body is immersed in this feeling of cool water. And so the pathway into samadhi becomes this initially effortful and then more and more effortless process of increasing focus and increasing or kneading into the whole being pleasure and ease. And that's a whole first sort of arc of it. Once the body kind of contacts extraordinary blissful pleasure, then it shifts into subtler and subtler pleasures. So it goes from like orgasmic pleasure into like happiness, and then just into like contentment, right? And then into pure equanimity and balance. So like, but the pathway in is you have to come through bodily joy, and then it settles into deep contentment. And I think in a way this is like an antidote to lifetimes of suffering. That it's hard to go from lifetimes of suffering into just dropping it all and being pristinely free. And so the pathway goes first through like, you know, hi, sweetie, I know it's been really hard. Let's put you in the bathtub, clean you off, give you an awesome meal, give you a massage, take care of your whole being, and then at some point be like, okay, now you're sort of back to normal. And we can get on with things. The blisses of samadhi suppress suffering. They remove the surface level angst or fear or contraction. And then they allow us to open more. And I think it's the purpose of pleasure to allow us to open more. And then as we open, we'll come into contact with deeper layers of suffering, of course. But we're nourished or fortified for them. And the way that in the Buddhist tradition this unfolded was an instruction to look deeply into the nature of experience. But when that gets exhausting or it starts to wear you down because there's so much difficulty, then enter samadhi. Gather your attention, cultivate that blissful feeling, and rest in the nourishment of embodied stability for as long as you like, until you feel ready to engage again with, you know, dealing with impermanence and the emptiness of the soul, etc. After the Buddha was enlightened, you know, he invented a system where the monks would eat in the morning and then spend the whole day doing practice and then gather to talk in the evening. And people would say, well, what do you do with your day? You're fully enlightened. And he would be like, I sit in jhana. Like, he spent the whole rest of his life hanging out in embodied pleasure. And then he would just come out and teach and then go back in. That's what he did. He came out, hung out with the king, advised him on some politics, tried to stop a war, went back and hung out in embodied pleasure. Like, that was his home base. And this is one of the invitations here. And I think in a mild way, it's what part of what happens when we come to a group like this over and over. I come to my meditation practice, and whatever's happening in my life, I get this little taste of like, ah. So the invitation of samadhi is just that little taste of, ah, can deepen tremendously if you learn how to follow that thread of focus and embodied ease and joy. So, taking a moment, letting that go. Thanks for your warm attention, for your focused and joyful attention. And some space for your thoughts, questions, curiosities about your own practice, about this topic, or anything else. Yeah, Andy.
I actually have a lot of questions because I was really fascinated by this kind of thing. But I wonder kind of too how, especially like Western idea of Vipassana fits into this. And is that like kind of, is this like sort of a modern invention? Or I feel like a lot of teachers kind of put this as like, well, like lots of traditions have things like jhana and concentration, but like Buddhism has this like Vipassana part.
Yeah, yeah, what is Vipassana in relation to this? Jhana and Vipassana were kind of isolated in the commentarial tradition as being two parallel paths of practice. The concentration path and the insight path, where Vipassana is this kind of investigation of experience that is based in strong concentration but is not single-pointed. So a very classic way of practicing this would be get super concentrated, get a really, really focused mind or a strong, powerful mind, but then don't just rest in those sublime states. Come out of them, and with that extremely powerful mind, investigate your life. And particularly, investigate impermanence. Notice how everything changes constantly, and nothing can be clung to. And when you notice that, notice how clinging is the source of your suffering. Right? And you can only see it if you can concentrate. Because if you can't concentrate, you're just going to flit off into distraction. And you're not going to notice that you did that because you're suffering. It's only the focused mind that can see clearly enough to discern the micro play of impermanence and suffering moment to moment. And then if you can see that, then you start to investigate who you actually are. And you see that you are a play of impersonal conditions, not a singular, separate, isolated individual. So that's the purpose of Vipassana. Some modern traditions, many different modern traditions of Vipassana arose in Burma and Thailand and Sri Lanka primarily now. Many of the ones that came to the West using the term Vipassana came from Burma. And they're all 20th century reinventions by different charismatic teachers who had an insight into a kind of practice. And there's different types, right? One type of Vipassana says you sweep your attention up and down through the body, right? Discerning subtle sensation everywhere. Another kind of Vipassana says just notice different sensory perceptions as they arise. Another kind of Vipassana says do super hard, heavy breathing until you've entirely blown your mind with oxygen and then sit stock still for an hour. Letting it all reverberate through your system. Very energetic style of practice. Another system focuses on slowly moving the limbs and noticing the flicker of intending and moving as a kind of ratchety sensation as you move, that there's no smoothness in movement once you dissect it profoundly. And there's lots more of systems. If you want a primer on those systems, you can read my teacher Jack Kornfield's book, Living Dharma, which is a profile of a dozen Burmese and Thai Vipassana teachers. When he wrote it in the 70s, it was called Living Buddhist Masters, but they all died, so now it's called Living Dharma. But it was about all these modern teachers and all of their different styles of practice, including like the Goenka style and others. So yes, they're modern inventions. They are attempts to do what the sutras or the suttas say. And but they all share this quality of understanding that there's the cultivation of focus and there's the cultivation of insight. There's a whole nother wing of the tradition right now that says very strongly that those two things aren't separate and that they weave together quite profoundly. There are now lineages that really emphasize jhana and lineages that don't emphasize it at all. So all of that is out there. Yeah. Yeah. Other thoughts here? Yes, here.
I've been reading the Dhammapada, and I just finished the chapters on age and old age.
Yeah.
And the language to me sounded a lot like Christian, like there's heaven and hell. Like there was that, there's a lot of like, if you're creating suffering now, you will be in suffering later.
Yep.
Or if you're and it's a conversation about karma too, I think.
Yep.
But it was surprising to me how similar the language was.
Yep.
To what I've heard, and I wonder like, you said today there's not like there's no heaven and hell in Buddhism. Yes?
There's no permanent heaven and hell. There totally are heavens and hells, but they're impermanent. There are gods, but they're impermanent. So partly it depends on what translation you're reading, because if you're reading a translation from like the late 19th century or the early 20th century, a lot of those are very colored by Christian language.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of, it depends who translated it, right?
Mm-hmm.
You very much in Buddhist cosmology, you know, you can land in the hell realms if you behave badly, or land in the heaven realms if you have good fortune. The difference to the Christian or Judeo-Christian or Judeo-Islamo-Christian worlds is that heaven and hell aren't permanent. You land there as long as your karma sustains in that direction, and you die from that form. They're just another place to get reborn. And so, like the Buddha says, over his gazillions of rebirths, he was born in the hells, he was born as animals, he was born in the human realm, he was born in the god realms. He was Indra, the king of the gods, several times. Meaning you could get reborn as Krishna or the Blessed Mother, if we want to be syncretic to Christianity. You could get reborn as one of the gods, or you may have already.
Mm-hmm.
And then you lived out a great cosmic eon as one of the gods. In this conception, the deities are not beings, but they're more like offices. You know, like you could get elected to be mayor, and then you'd serve that term for a while, and that would be who you were, and then you would die as mayor and be reborn as something else.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you could be Indra or Krishna or Durga, and then you would have a whole lifetime as Durga, which could be an entire cosmic eon, right? Worlds arising and falling, and you are Durga, and you do the whole thing. You kill the buffalo, you save the world, you rampage around, you have mad, kind of wild tantric relationship with Shiva, and at the end of the entire cosmic eon, it all dissolves into the void, and you're, in the Buddhist conception, your karma as Durga ends, and you die and you're reborn somewhere else, based on your karma. This partly shows up in Buddhism as a little bit of a, you know, there's places that where the Buddha's actually teasing the Hindus, the early Hindus, about this. I've told some of those stories before. But the idea is that heaven and hell, absolutely, you could get born in, and you can get out of, right? So, and again, you can think of all of these as psychological metaphors, within a lifetime. You know, you might have a phase in your life, or any one of us might have a phase in our life where we like, what if I just like kind of lost it and got like, you know, what if I got like crazy addicted to a really painful substance, and then I like lost my mind for a while and had a psychotic break and was hospitalized and really like just like broke from everything and had a really bad period, whatever we call that. And then at some point, like, kind of got my wits together and got into recovery and sort of climbed out. We could say, oh, my karma unfolded such that I died from my privileged, comfortable existence and I was born in a hell realm or a very painful realm for a while. And some karma had to work itself out and you know, and perhaps I had the good fortune then to climb out of that and to recover. And so the hell realms are like that, you know, that they exist.
And in Hinduism too, same kind of thing, right?
same thing in Hinduism, yeah. Post the Vedas. In the earliest Vedas, there's no reincarnation. So in the Rig Veda, you just go to heaven if you do all the proper rites.
Mm-hmm.
And you either go to heaven or you don't. But once the reincarnation doctrine gets embedded, and it shows up somewhere in the sort of early Upanishads, which is like 5 to 700 BCE, the doctrine of reincarnation starts to kind of be the primary worldview. Once that gets established, then, yeah, you're cycling through the realms. And the teaching that you can go to any of these different realms and keep going around and around is the same in both Buddhism and Hinduism. And the only thing really different is the idea of what liberation consists of. In many of the Hindu systems, liberation consists in realizing that you were never separate from God to begin with. And in the Buddhist systems, it consists in realizing that you never existed at all to begin with. They both include the realization that you never were a separate individual. And the only difference really is what you think you're becoming in the end, which is, do you become everything or do you become nothing? And honestly, once you're talking about everything or nothing, the distinction doesn't matter to me. It's easy enough for a privileged California hippie to say that I have solved 3,000 years worth of philosophical argument between two major world religions. So it's more complex than that. But from where I sit, those doctrines are pretty harmonious, actually. And I'm not alone in that, but it's also that's not a universally held view. Yeah, Lydia.
So I come to meditation as a result of suffering in my life and seeking ways to relieve myself of suffering, and I got interested in mindfulness practice as this simple sort of like observation and witness and compassionate practice and.
Yeah.
And I sort of just started getting curious about Buddhism, and I started coming here, and I started, like, reading a few books and talking to friends about it. And I think, for me, at this point, I'm kind of really hung up on this whole reincarnation bit. I'm kind of, like, stuck there and a little bit, like, let down or, like, irritated about it.
Yeah.
And I'm like, no, you know, like, this is like other religions. This is, like, what Buddhism isn't to me, which is, like, this practical application of, like, you know, a right way or a good way to be in the world that, that creates goodness, you know.
Yeah.
And so when I hear you talking about it, I mean, maybe it's this, like, the difference between, like, you know, metaphor and, like, literal communication.
Mm-hmm.
But I just have this hard time of believing that there's, like, you know, people who claim to know something that seems unknowable, and then also that it just doesn't seem like it, like on a broader sort of like meta context, I can see how like we are all one with like everything, not just as people, but like as, you know,
totally
as like energy that like gets redistributed and then like comes back as other things and these types of things.
Yep.
But anyway, I just was wondering if you could talk a little bit about like what the Buddhist understanding of reincarnation is and like
I'm glad you're saying it. It's a hard one.
Yeah.
In all sorts of ways. particularly for lots of us who weren't raised in a culture that has it as a worldview.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, like, I'm coming from a different world. I was Catholic. Like, I'm coming from that worldview, or some attempt, at least, in them to instill that worldview in me. I'm not sure it worked. To this, at least I'm coming from, like, Western materialism as a worldview.
That as well, science.
Right? Yeah.
Nothing
happens. Totally. But it's interesting, the thing that you say, where, like, if we think of literal reincarnation in the kind of classic New Agey, like, oh, I realized that I was Cleopatra,
yeah.
Right? How many people have been Cleopatra? So many, right? Like, if we think of it in that literal way, it seems a little supernatural. It's like, eh, I'm not sure about that. But already, you know, Buddhism is like, yeah, that's not how it is anyway, because that would depend on you having a separate, you know, like, discrete self. Like, you died in this body, and then you were born as a, you know, a bricklayer in Mumbai, and then you died as that, and you were born as a classical violinist in Copenhagen, and then you died as, you know, whatever. But the thing you said, like, oh, it makes sense that there, that, like, we're all connected, and there's just energy, and energy disperses and takes other forms. You know, this is one of the laws of thermodynamics, right? If we're going to go Western, the energy is neither created nor destroyed. So, like, the heat leaves my body when I die, and it goes into the atmosphere or into the ground, and, like, the nutrients of my body go into the ground, and like, the worm, whatever, the whole thing, I become oak trees and sky and whatever. What if actually the literal idea of reincarnation is simply the an overly literal dreaming into, or a version of the insight that that is true, that of what you said, that, like, if I take a really vast view and I notice that, like, oh, there's the sense that I am in this body, and then there's the sense that, like, this body just becomes, you know, corn and wheat and trees and rain, and corn and wheat and trees and rain become pigs and cows and sheep and humans. And honestly, being a parent now, like, I look at my kid and I'm like, where'd you come from? You are some part of me, which is really strange, right? I'm just like, I actually have no idea how this is possible, that you came from me, you know, and not being the one to bear the child, it's a little more abstract, right? Like, Sarah has a different sense of how he came from her. But still, at some point when we were pregnant, I was like, dude, what if that whole reincarnation thing actually is just a weird way of saying, like, family? As in, we're family with everything that has come before. I came from somewhere. What if I'm just a reincarnation of my dad and my granddad and my mom and my grandma in a kind of simple way? And I'm a reincarnation of, you know, wheat and sugars and minerals and all this stuff. So I think of the literal model as excessively literal. At the same time, so many of the early texts talk about it in a mysteriously literal way. The Buddha says, I was this kind of being, I was that kind of being. And I don't have any good materialistic explanation for that. You know, it's like I've read stories, right, of reincarnations, like a child is, you know, being taken through a village and suddenly is like, stop here, stop here, stop here, and jumps out of the car and runs down a side street and says, I live here. And then they investigate and investigate, and it turns out that somebody died. They're like, there's some hint of, like, how could the child do that? You know this thing. And those are just mysterious to me. I don't know, right? That's like, okay, there's more things in heaven and earth than are dreamt of by your philosophy, you know. But really the explanation that you gave feels to me also like the basis of where this would arise from. That, like, it's clear that we're not isolated individuals inseparable from everything else. Like I'm connected in exactly the way you said. And what if that's what's true on a material level? And then, and this is the part that gets, that requires a little leap of faith. What if that's also true in relation to consciousness? The thing that I think of as my inner self or my being. And that one is less obviously true on a material level. And it's the thing that Western science also has no clue about, right? The Western scientists are like, we've looked everywhere and we can't find the thing called consciousness. And, you know, and all the mystics are like, of course you can't, silly, it's not material. But that leaves us with what is called in philosophy the hard problem, right? Which is, it's not just about past lives, it's actually about this one. Like, who are you? Like, what is this thing that thinks you're a being that has this kind of isolated separateness? Why don't you just understand that you're part of the flow of the ecosystem? And what Buddhism proposes is that when you see clearly enough to recognize that you're the flow of the ecosystem, that problem also disappears. That you understand not just that the body is interwoven with everything, but that the mind is inseparable from the body and is also interwoven with everything. So that's a non-answer. But
it's a non-question too. So.
Well, yeah. In a sense, I really bow to the fact that to really any time these old doctrines kind of get in us as a kind of bug and are just like, I don't just accept it on blind faith. Like, I wrestle with it. And I'm just like, what does that really mean to me? Like, because it meant something in a culturally specific way to those people at that time. What could it mean to me? And the piece that does still mean something to me is that I don't really know what happens after I die. Like, I don't have a experiential knowing of that. I haven't had visions or a felt sense of that so much. But it makes sense to me that something should happen. Because if nothing happens, then again, I don't understand action. I don't understand why it's all happening if nothing at all happens. So whether or not I'm conscious of that thing happening or whether I get to feel like an individual experiencing that thing happening, I don't have no idea. Maybe my individual consciousness does just snuff out like a light, but that wasn't the point ever. And maybe all of that was a delusion, and all of this is just the ecosystem unfolding. That becomes a very tantric teaching, you know. There's one massive being that you might as well call goddess. And what I am is like a flicker of vibration in the context of that whole thing, you know. And so maybe I disappear, but that wasn't what it was about anyway. You know, and she continues forever, is one way of saying it. Yeah. Yeah, thanks for bringing it in. I'll end with saying that in the Zen tradition, there's a tradition that says questions like this are a manifestation of what's called the great doubt. And the great doubt is like the existential, the deepest pit of your stomach, like what is this existence thing, is the great doubt. And in the early Buddhist traditions, they're like, no, doubt is a hindrance, resolve it, have faith, da, da, da. In the Zen tradition, there are traditions that say, only maintain the great doubt. No matter what happens, don't lose touch with that. One Korean Zen teacher says, it's don't know mind. Don't ever lose don't know mind. Whatever happens, just go, don't know. What does it mean? Don't know. You know? In other words, don't ever let yourself land at certainty. Because if you think you're certain, you're wrong. It's not the whole thing yet. Right? So you say, only keep great doubt. Those were the first teachings I came into Buddhism through. It was fierce Zen. So keep great doubt. Focus the mind. See you soon. So thanks for being here. Really a pleasure. It's a joy to talk about the all everything with you, and to hear your voices and to sit together. We continue to offer this group fully on the subtle practice of gift economy. Your generosity of resources helps others with lesser resources to come, sustains the studio and myself both in our offering. Thank you for your generosity all the time. Offerings are collected in the pretty Tibetan box in the shelf there, or if you have class passes or anything here at the studio, you can also do electronic business at the desk. See you next week. Many blessings.
Thank you. Yeah. Thanks.